They are speaking like, yeah, they know past, present, and future. So when they think of what has just happened because of that potency of the Lord, the Lord explains this to Arjuna as well, this potency of his to know the past, the present, and the future. Vedaham samasitani, Vartmanani chavarjuna, Bhavishyam chavutani mamkulivana kashana. O Arjuna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, I know everything that has happened in the past, all that is happening in the present, and all things that are yet to come. I also know all the entities that we know and knows. And of course, this all-pervasive nature, this is in the form of the Lord's super soul, how the Lord is present within every universe, every atom, and within the heart of every single living entity. So the Lord is aware of the happenings of the living entities who are but minute parts and parcels of Him. So the followers of, the demigods are aggrieved. They do not know what to do. So they are approaching Lord Shiva, they are approaching Lord Brahma to try to get some answers. And even the wife of Daksha, does anyone remember who the wife of Daksha is? One of the daughters of Swamiwala? There was already Devahuti, Akuti, and
Prasuti.
So even Prasuti, the wife of Daksha, having the knowledge, of course, in the Vedic time, the Vanashram system is that the king not only maintains his praja, his citizens, by educating them maturely, but also the king was a Rajarishi, saint among the kings. So he would educate even his family members in spiritual subject matter. So it's not a surprise that even the princesses had knowledge of the absolute truth. It's not surprising that these ladies had strong wisdom and knowledge that they could actually approach life by using the philosophy. Just as Sati, prior to this chapter, was explaining to her father Daksha about the position of Lord Shiva according to his tattva and how he should be respected in that instance, not just as a wife defending her husband, but also on a spiritual level. She was well informed, she had that transcendental knowledge, she had been educated in that. So it was always the duty of the kings to educate the citizens and allow them to gradually grow spiritually and receive that enlightenment at the end of their life. So Prasuti could understand how her husband, Daksha, had offended Lord Shiva by lack of acknowledgement. And it is for that reason that Sati was also very much aggrieved at the amount of disrespect and offensive attitude of the father. So even the mother was able to see this clearly. But in this entire past, we understand there's actually no possibility of enjoying and trying to be happy in this world when one offends a great devotee. And it's very, very difficult to try to be happy in this mature world by being offensive. So even if we take, if we look at what's happening to the planet, Mother Earth, in many cultures, there is a deity of the Earth, not just in not just in India, is there an understanding of Bhumi Devi, but also in many, we could say even indigenous cultures, they worship their sun god, they worship their rain god, they worship the goddess of the earth. So there's an understanding that there should be respect given to agents of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, even in the form of the material energy. So this respect for divinity coming down through Mother Earth is something that is important for proper functioning, even for material existence. And when that is lacking, we see an imbalance. We see an imbalance and lack of resources, or the opposite, where we have the miseries caused by nature. And that is happening constantly in this world. We see the extreme heat, I've been waiting for the floods to come since Friday. You know, it was, it's a 10 out of 10. It's a whopping 10 out of 10. And I remember going to work and thinking, oh my gosh, what if things flow over? I can't get home. I'll just go to the temple. I'll take shelter at the temple. And Friday went by, Saturday went by. It was just normal rain. Sunday came, it was normal. And I'm like, But of course, it's not always like that. And we still have many Australians who are stranded in Bali because of the volcanic situation there. And many places, Hurricane Katrina, you name it, there are many natural disasters that are taking place. And these are the miseries of mature existence. Adi Atmika, Adi Devika, and Adi Bhautika. When there is no proper recognition as to who the maintainer, the proprietor is of even the material energy, then there's a reaction. There's a reaction for everything, that these are the laws of the universe. These are the laws of karma. So how can one be possible when one is trying to exploit, enjoy separately, and offend those who are representing the Supreme Lord? It is very, very difficult to try and be happy. Now, the very nature of the material world is that one has to become fearful. Fear is such an embedded, it's embedded in the society that we live in. We're constantly fearful of everything. Right? Whether it is on a conscious or subconscious level, in order to get by in material existence, you know, Krishna explains in the Gita when he speaks of lust, and he explains how lust is the all-devouring sinful enemy of this world. It's in the third chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. How he explains how this lust, generally in this world, people think lust to be just between attraction to the opposite sex on a body platform, or the same sex on the body platform. But lust goes further to explain the enjoying nature of the spirit soul separate from its true identity. So it's not just about bodies enjoying, but even the subtle form of enjoyment of other bodies and expansions of the bodies and expansions in a subtle way of name, fame, adoration, extension, etc. So these are forms of lust. And when you combine lust with ferocious appetite to enjoy, you become implicated in simple activities. Whether it is by cheating, whether it is by lying or creating illusion, falling into illusion, we become implicated in simple activities to feed our sinful desires or to try to satisfy the lust propensity. So just by being in this material world, there's this great lust that attacks those of us who are on the body platform. So not only is it difficult to be happy in this material world if you live your life by offending representatives of the Lord or great devotees of the Lord, it's even more difficult when you have this lusty propensity and you try to enjoy even further. You only become implicated in more simple activities, and it becomes like a never-ending cycle of birth, death, old age, and disease. It's a never-ending cycle. So this quality of fear is necessary for the material world to exist. If we're not fearful, the material world becomes a smooth-sailing place. But there's so much fear that's embedded in everything. Why do we have so much cosmetics and science researching into longevity, prolonging life, and cloning, and all sorts of things? Because we're fearful that this body is going to die. Therefore, we must do something to try to stop this natural occurrence. Right? Krishna has already explained the six body changes, that every body being has to go through. No one can escape this. But through science, persons are trying to do that. Persons are trying to escape death and disease And these things are going to come. That's what it means to have a natural body. We are going to be afflicted by these changes. We'll be born. Everyone here is born. Unless you're some extraordinary soul who just appeared, dropped in front of the house by a pelican or whatever. We are born, we stay for some time, we grow, we produce some byproducts. Sometimes people skip that stage, you don't produce byproducts. Nevertheless, you start deteriorating, and then the material body vanishes. Every living being is going to go through this. Whether it takes 5 years or 10 years or 12 or 60 or 100, it's going to happen. So in the material world, there's fear surrounding these body changes because they're not being understood as temporary changes. Krishna explains in the Gita that the body is temporary, that it goes through changes. But a sober person is not bewildered by these changes. We know that it's just like taking off one garment and putting on another the next day. That's all it is. That is transmigration of the soul. So long as we have not reached perfection, we're going to take one body after the other. But one who is not sober in thought and in mind, one who is bewildered by these realities of material existence, hankers to try to go against nature. Nature has already decided it is going to happen. I was listening to an interview Srila Prabhupada had on television years back, obviously, 1972, I think. And Prabhupada was being asked, you know, about feminism and the role of women, etc. Then Swamiji, are women in your movement equal to men? Prabhupada was like, on the spiritual platform, yes, but there are physical differences, so no, they're not equal on that platform. On the social thing, they're not equal. And this reporter started asking a bit about how can you say that they can do the same job, etc. And Prabhupada was saying, I'm not saying that nature has already decided, it is not up to me. And Prabhupada explained, it is not up to me that men cannot bear children, as in carry a child. It is only the woman who can do that. Nature decided that. Nature decided that the bodies will develop a certain way for the male and the female species. It is nature who has decided. It is not me. And there was nothing the reporter could say. What do you say? Nature has decided. Are we going to have an argument for eternity why the sun rises in the east and sets in the west? It's been decided. The sun rises in the east for everyone. It sets in the west for everyone. So nature has decided. It's not that Bhagavad Gita is such a stringent law book and it is dry and it is anti-woman, anti-this, whatever. Nature has already decided. There's nothing we can say. That is the fact, whether we like to hear it or not. So in this material world, there's so many things have already been decided because we have a material body. We will experience adi-atmika. There's just no question about it. I do not know any person who says they have not experienced a misery from another living entity. I don't know any single, so even the plant species or the animals, if we could have a conversation, I don't think they can say they've never experienced that misery. Whether it's in the ocean, they're being fished or poached in the wildlife, or the bacteria is being destroyed by a fiery stomach acid, whatever it is, there's adi-atmika for everybody. We live in nature, and when nature is out of balance because of the exploitation and the lack of love and appreciation for Mother Nature, there's a reaction for it. Either extreme heat, extreme cold, seasons out of whack, whatever it is, tremendous earthquakes and traumas and volcanic eruptions that are just so devastating, these things happen. disease, it happens. We've all been to the dentist at some point. Some of us will need glasses at some point. We've had braces. Whatever it may be, these miseries are there. And when we want to enjoy that which is not eternal, like I mentioned, when we try to enjoy that which is not eternal, we become more and more implicated in sinful activities. So that which is eternal, whether it's our body, our senses, our gender, our temporary name and fame, we become implicated in sinful life. We do things to address the agenda of name and fame. And these are planting seeds of activity for a next life, which means a new body. So there are those unmanifested reactions that are just waiting. And every time we try to calculate our lustful desires, every time we try to calculate how much we're going to enjoy, every action has a reaction, so we're just planting more and more seeds that are going to grow and give fruit. And all of this is happening in material existence. So the more material desire we try to please, the more that it keeps growing. Krishna has already explained that material desires, they burn like fire. They can never be satisfied fully. So to a smart person, intelligent person will try to figure out how not to get bound by the stringent laws of material nature. And all these laws that I've mentioned, the Atmika, the Devika, the Bhautika, these miseries caused by our own mind, our own body, other living entities and nature that is around us, the process of birth, death, old age and disease. If we try to solely understand what these things are by virtue of a process, we'll become extricated from being stuck in that maze. When we come to our senses, we become purified and we become protected by the Supreme Lord. It is one thing to acknowledge these changes or these faults within material existence, but acknowledgement is simply not enough. Like, oh yeah, the body is going to die, yeah, I'm going to get disease, or yes, this is going to happen. What are we going to do about the situation in the long run? Most of us here, probably most of us, under 40. So the body is still great, still functions. We can still eat anything. And there'll come a time when things start to slow down. Every day I'm seeing more and more gray hairs. Every day on my head. It's just old age is starting to creep up. And I'm thinking, okay, it's almost time. So we should try to think about what are we going to do to try to get out of this situation for good. I recognize that the material world is temporary. It is full of faults and misery. But what am I going to do about it? And this is where the bona fide process of Krishna consciousness comes in, where we're being given these signs of self-realization. How to slowly come out of material existence while still living in the material world. So it's not that we have to physically die first. We can still try to maintain a level of spirituality while still walking this earth, as Jesus Christ would say. Live in this world, but don't be on it. So the natural proclivity of the disease or a conditioned soul in this material world, although we might not use these exact words, but this is how it actually is. When I first read this chapter, Divine and Demonic Natures in the Bhagavad Gita, I thought, oh, what a title. So you can either be divine or demonic. I'm like, in between, yes, no, it can be a little bit like this, or a bit like that. But then I as the years went on, I understood more and more what divine and demonic meant. It's not that there'll be people walking around with triple six on their forehead, or, you know, like how, I don't know, I come from a Christian background, and a demon the way we were taught what demoniac is a beast, a physical beast, and there's horns coming out, or it's like red eyes, and just, that's what we thought. But there's a mentality also, there's demonic mentality. And demonic mentality is rejecting the authority of Krishna as he gives it to his devotees and as he gives in his books. So that's, when you reject the authority of Krishna, that is a demonic mentality. But we are rejecting the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the cause of all causes. So, I remember reading to my friends this chapter when I was in university, and they couldn't digest, but they could relate with this one particular verse. The demonic person thinks this is Bhagavad Gita 16:16. So much wealth do I have today, and I will gain more according to my schemes. Right? The wealthiest, for even you don't even have to be a millionaire to think like this. Even at your normal everyday job, is thinking, how can I get more? We're always, that's just how society has been teaching us. So much is mine now, and it will increase in the future more and more. You know, we want more. Why not have 5,000? Why not have more money in the bank account? Whether you're using it or not, that's a big question mark. But it's all about having more. He is my enemy and I have killed him, and my other enemies will also be killed. And this might not necessarily be the physical act of killing, but also when we kill a person's spirit, when we kill a person's intelligence or ability to think for themselves instead of just following the mass consensual truths, and then sometimes explained by Devaki Swami, that we just follow the ways of life without questioning anything. It's like we're in a trance. Okay, this is what we do. We have to be on Twitter. Okay, you have to take selfies. Okay, I take selfies. Oh, I have to have this set. Okay, I'm going to do this to my head. Oh, I have to be into feminism. Okay, I'm a feminist. Oh, I have to be into health. There's so many things that you get pushed into without inquiring about what is it and why is it beneficial or not. I am the Lord of everything. I am the enjoyer. Nah, I've never walked around prior to my Krishna consciousness saying I am the Lord of everything, I am the enjoyer. But I clearly thought I was the enjoyer. I clearly thought I was the center. Right? Dress up nicely, go to a place, everyone looks at you, talks to you. You know, you get this feeling of, yes, I am important. Right? For how long? Till the next best thing walks in? Right? So we get an illusion sense of the self based on our body, reputation, our name, fame, and our wealth. All these opulences, our education. Not knowing that in a few seconds there'll be another person who's more wealthy than you, who's much more educated, who's much more opulent. And the list goes on. And when that happens, there's a fear of, oh, my name, who I relate to is being trampled upon, therefore I should try and succeed and scheme to be back on top. And this is how, as I mentioned, we go back and we become implicated in simple activities because we're trying to go back on top. But the nature of this world is that one minute you're up and the next minute you're down. That's just how it is. I'm perfect, powerful, and happy. I just try to read books to anyone on the street. I'm fine, I'm happy. I'm alright. Yes, I'm fine. I'm perfect. Yes, I have my lip injections. I have my fake hair. I have my fake plastic body. I am perfect. And this is, and it's not only the women who are doing this these days. Men are also starting to go down that route of having, and this is something that just blew my mind, calf implants for men. Who cares? Who looks at your calves? Anyway, more men are getting calf implants. More men are getting fake beards, facial hair. I couldn't believe it. They just rip it out and stick it on. And I was thinking, wow. The body identification, it is so thick that generally, yes, ladies are more interested in being comfortable, the body looking pretty, etc. But now when it gets to the opposite sex, where they're putting calf implants and fake beards and fake hair, some of them even have, they do surgery to put like fake tricep muscles and stuff. Oh yes. It's happening. And this is all to try and be perfect, to try to look perfect. And it just makes you do things that are so dangerous to yourself and to those that are around you. And you keep on thinking, yes, my identity is just the body. There's nothing more to me but the body. And therefore, I just work on this body and this is who I am. So our identity really stops with the body. It is really, really ludicrous how creams make people feel like they're the best thing ever. But the makeup industry, it's a billion-dollar industry, which tells you that there's something wrong with you. I'm not against anybody who uses makeup, please. That's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying for the wrong reasons, people cannot exist in this world without painting their face. Sometimes people do not want to do anything so long as they don't look a certain way, which is very, very superficial. I read a documentary, this happens a lot in China, and in a lot of the Asian countries. Ladies do a lot of plastic surgery to have a certain shaped nose, like the Caucasian nose. Brow lift, because the eyes are different, which I find nothing wrong with anyway. Brow lift, chiseled chin to try to have a Western look. And some of them, it has backfired. Now their bodies are deformed, their faces are deformed because of these surgeries to try to look a certain way, to try and be perfect. So these things are very much dangerous, and they're being put out there that if you want to succeed in life, you have to look a certain way. But no matter how much Botox, no matter how many surgeries you perform, the body is going to collapse. The body is going to deteriorate. Why not care for the body, which is a temple of the Lord? The body has been given by Mother Nature. We have been given a body to exist in, to go through our journey in life. Therefore, we can maintain it nicely to serve Krishna and to try to achieve our perfection of life. We can maintain it by taking care of what goes in. Right? The best way to if you have a diesel car and you put petrol in, you're not putting the right food for that car. So the right food for this vehicle, we're herbivores. Many people, they just refuse. But if I'm joining a gym, I'm looking for a place where I can really exercise and take care of Krishna's body, they always say to me, oh, you're vegetarian. It's going to be hard. I'm thinking, why? I thought, you know, your protein and your iron levels, there must be a lot. I'm like, no. And so where do you get your protein? And I give them a whole list of lentils and beans. I give them a whole list of things. And they're like, oh. But well, you can have powder. I'm like, no, actually the powder is just meant to enhance what you're already taking. Not that the powder is going to substitute. Like, you don't eat your greens, but you'll guzzle a whole lot of wheatgrass and throw in it. It's supposed to just enhance and help out. But most people think that being a vegetarian and trying to be healthy is difficult for you and for the body, because you won't get enough B12, you won't get enough protein, you won't get enough omega-3 acids or B complexes. And you know, you go down the list, you give them chia, you give them hemp, there's no excuse. Or when they think you're being sentimental, if you're being too spiritual about it, all the animals have a soul and whatnot, and then you just say, okay, let's just be real now, scientifically, A herbivore chews a certain way, a carnivore chews a certain way. Carnivores goes up and down. The jaw does this, it does not go side to side. We chew our food, we can move our jaw. Carnivores don't do that. We do not have canines like dogs and hyenas. We're not ripping things apart. The acid in our stomach, it is spread out. Our intestines are 6 times as long as our body fat. So even just physically, our bodies are meant to eat a certain type of food. But it's interesting that people are trying to be health conscious artificially when they can actually do it naturally. They'd rather be artificial than natural. I find it very strange. Artificially, we're injecting things. Artificially, we're tucking things out. But you can maintain the same principle by eating in a certain way. And by living your life in a certain way, it can happen naturally. So this is the thing, so as not to get implicated in sinful activity, so that the cycle doesn't keep on going birth, lifetime after lifetime, we stop with these sinful activities. We take to a process that will help us understand philosophically who we are separate from the body, understand how we do get implicated in material life and sinful activities. We transform our desires, we try to desire spiritually, we try to have spiritual vision in what we see, even as we live in this material world. And that does a world of difference. It changes our character and our behavior. There is none so powerful and happy as I am. I mean, it's not possible that you're the most powerful being on this planet. To think that there's no one as powerful, I'm sure Donald Trump thinks he's the most powerful man. And sometimes when we hear of presidency, they will say the most powerful man on the planet is the president of the United States of America, whoever it is at that time. But where is the power when people are killing each other on the street? Where's his power? Where is his power when nature is creating havoc? Where is the power? No one is that powerful. No one is supremely powerful but Krishna. I shall perform sacrifices, I shall give some charity, and thus I shall rejoice. In this way, such persons are deluded by ignorance. So sometimes for the feel-good sensation, perform sinful activity Monday to Friday, Saturday, give some charity, and Sunday, get ready for Monday to Friday. And that is how sometimes living the conditioned soul feels better about himself. Oh, I gave a homeless guy a cigarette. Yeah, sometimes you see people doing that. This person clearly has no lungs left, and they ask for money from you for a cigarette, and you give them. That's charity in the world of ignorance. Krishna addresses a different way you can give in charity in the Bhagavad Gita. So this section, when I read it to my friends, they were like, oh yeah, that is kind of true. This is how sometimes we behave, because we do not have a clear vision or understanding. When we come to the process of Krishna consciousness, which takes us beyond just material existence, beyond what the body, mind, and senses can do for us, we become purified in thought and action, and we start feeling this protection by the Supreme Lord. There's a huge weight that is removed from our shoulders. You know, in the Nectar of Devotion, it speaks about the step, Kleshavni, when one comes to Krishna consciousness, you feel this this initial bliss. I know I felt it. I'm still trying to get there, get back to that blissful state. It's just perfect. You hear Krishna's name, you see the deity. I can even still remember the particular smell of incense when I came to Krishna consciousness. It just brings back everything. And then you feel this relief of material existence. Not that all of a sudden you become a pure devotee. No, it's just that now you've come into contact with the higher energy, with the higher taste. So it's like, wow. It's an amazing experience that it hits your body. That's why all these activities, Nectar of Devotion explains, even just smelling the incense of the Lord, smelling the flowers, wearing the garlands that the Lord has been wearing, taking Charanamrita, or when the water of the Lord comes, it's not just like an ordinary thing, yeah, sprinkle, 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 here there's a flower, it's so mechanical. But actually these activities, they can bring about a spiritual realization. When you smell a flower or an incense, it is purifying. I know for myself, I used to read in Nectar of Devotion and think, how is sprinkling on whatever do anything for me spiritually? Smelling incense. But after a good 15 years, I can start to see this. When I smell incense that's been offered to Krishna or the flower, there's a subtle change inside of me. There's something that happens. Even just blowing the conch. But there's a lot of purification that comes from these aspects of performing Krishna consciousness. So instead of being in an ignorant state, we come out of these lower modes and we try to be situated on the transcendental platform. And that's where we can access Krishna even more. So yesterday when Prabhu was given class, he spoke about these, you know, surrendering to Krishna. And sometimes it might seem like such a daunting thing, or you have to surrender. For what, you surrendered? Have you given up everything? It's like, I still have something behind here. I haven't given everything. It is a process, you know, because this process of bhakti, it controls Krishna. It actually does. It controls Krishna's heart. So of course, to get there, one has to purify the heart completely. And there are different steps, of course, to surrender. Accepting things that are favorable to Krishna consciousness and rejecting those which are not. And clarity of that is revealed more and more as we mature in Krishna consciousness, but also through the association of devotees. They help us and they teach us what is favorable and what is not. And we use our intelligence, not that every time someone tells us what to do, but because we are reading and we're associating with devotees, our intelligence becomes sharp and we're able to see what is favorable and what is not favorable to Krishna consciousness. And we start developing a firm belief in the Lord's protection, that Krishna is my ultimate protector. Not just saying it, but actually believing it. Every step of our life, we keep having that realization. And we feel exclusive, this is the fourth step, exclusive dependence on the Lord. Now you should think step 3 and 4, you know, you believe firmly in the Lord's protection, but this one says it's exclusive. So not that your bank account is giving you shelter, or your wife or your husband, or your opulence or your beauty, that is where you feel the shelter, but actually it's just when you get to a point where Krishna is just exclusively the person you depend on. Now this is, you know, taking it up a notch. Having no interest separate from the interest of the Lord, this is the fifth step of Saranagati, of surrender. And these things that we study in Bhakti Shastri classes, that gradually over time we try to develop the same vision, the same mood and vision of our spiritual master, of the parampara. Our vision is to be realigned in our natural constitutional position as servants of Krishna. And our vision, of course, extending to give Krishna to others. It might come in different ways for different people, but we try to bring other conditioned souls back to the shelter of Krishna. So that should be our life's mission, that is our focus, at least for myself. And eventually just always seeing ourselves meek and humble. No matter how advanced we are, no matter how well known we are, we're still just a tiny part and parcel of Krishna. We're always small. Krishna is always magnificent. He is vivid. And we will always be Anu. We're always that marginal energy. So we always feel ourselves meek and humble despite our advancement and progress. We are always taking shelter of someone. And we see that in the life of the Acharyas. We see that in the life of even the topmost servants of the Lord in Vrindavan Dham. They are always under someone's shelter. They are always being guided how to serve the divine couple. Always. Although they've achieved perfection, they still take shelter. They have a guide who will show them always how to serve Krishna. So this is what we're striving for. We're striving to extricate ourselves from the sinful life, trying to come to the stage of surrender by purifying our senses and taking shelter of Krishna. And in that way, we will shy away from offending those who are dear to Krishna, and hopefully make our way back home, back to Godhead. I shall stop there and ask if there's any comments or questions, or questions, clarifications, and
you spoke about surrender, yeah? So what's a practical, like, you know, in day-to-day life, what is it that one can do to actually practice that surrender? Because it's theoretically, it makes sense.
Yeah, like I said, I mentioned the six steps of surrender. So the first two, accepting things favorable and rejecting that which is unfavorable. So you can be walking down the shop or doing whatever, you have a scent, there's a smell, there's foodstuffs there, it is boga, be rejected. Yeah. That is surrender in itself. We are rejecting something. It's not favorable because we understand that consciousness goes into food. We don't go to certain places because we know it's not conducive to Krishna consciousness. You won't find any of us in a club. Right? It's intoxication, illicit activities, gambling. You won't find us there because we might just get implicated in something. So we reject certain places because they won't be conducive. And on a daily basis, we practice the four principles and we chant Hare Krishna. So we're trying to always take shelter of the Lord, chanting Hare Krishna and always reading the text. That is a way of surrendering our mind and our intelligence to Krishna, to Rishikesh, the master of the senses. So we're trying to use our entire body to serve Krishna. We might be working, we're maintaining our Krishna consciousness, so our that Lakshmi, that money that we're getting gets purified by engaging it in supporting the deities and supporting the spreading of Krishna consciousness. So all these things that we do, offering our prasadam, these are ways of surrender. Coming here this morning, this is something that is favorable to your Krishna consciousness. That's an aspect of surrender.
How do you bring that
ecstatic first 2 weeks of Krishna consciousness that I'm still chasing?
Start all over again.
Start all over again. Well, every day you're starting all over again. So I often look towards associating with persons who I can see they're very enthusiastic and confident in Krishna consciousness. So whether it's him or just being around them, sometimes they're much older devotees, sometimes they're much younger. But I'm chasing that enthusiasm to serve, to hear, to chant. And hopefully I can get from that association, it will rub off and I will go back and refocus. Because it can be there forever. It's just that along the way we become familiar with the process. Oh yeah, Baba's in class. Oh, who's here? No, I'll go tomorrow. Or, oh, I don't like the tree anymore. I mean, we become familiar with the process of bhakti sometimes, and that's why we kind of, not that we lose taste, but we don't really see the potency of it and how it can be dynamic at every step. So try to seek that association that inspires you, where you can see these devotees are surrendering and they're confident and they're enthusiastic in their service. And also, the more you read, the more you keep infusing yourself. The life of Prabhupada, just reading Bhagavatam, Bhagavad Gita, Chaitanya Charitamrita, and that will get you out of that comfort zone, out of that state of being complacent. So try to seek out that association. And of course, praying to Krishna and focusing on our japa. Not that the japa becomes mechanical, right? It's just like, you know, you're just chanting with your mouth, not with the heart. So you need to just refocus. My mother told me one thing, I'll end with this. She said once, to my brothers, actually, when they were starting to grow up, adolescents, of course now I see, although she was giving them one lesson, I took another lesson from it. And she was talking about, she gave them an egg to hold, and then she told them to run up and down really fast. They're like, what's going on? Run, because my mother's a headmistress, so she always told the students we could not lie to her about anything because she's heard it all. And she's working for 40 years, so she knew every excuse in the world. So she's like, my brother, like, why are you running up and down in egg? So they're running up and down, and at some point they stopped and said, you know, we're going to drop it, it's so fragile. And she told them, yes, you treat everybody that you meet with the same care and attention. So when I remembered this sentence, and I thought, I should treat my Krishna consciousness with this same care and attention that I don't drop. And so in the beginning, it's like I was chanting, like my lips were about to fall off. Like, my God, everything was just like, chant, yes. Right? I was so careful. And then over time, offenses crept in, pride, illusion, madness. But now I want to go back to that attention. So we can regain that back by association, by japa, and taking shelter of the pastimes of the Lord. Alright, thank you very much for your attention. Jai.